First, extreme heat has covered huge parts of the United States for long stretches of time over the course of this summer. As of just yesterday, over 60 million people in the U.S. were under heat alerts, and that zone of high heat is expected to continue and expand over the weekend. Extreme heat can be lethal, but we don't always take it seriously. Why? Our next guest says that heat waves and global warming in general have a PR problem. He says that phrases like global warming and extreme heat don't capture the true scale and depth of destruction and threat to human and animal lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you lived in parts of the country with extreme heat? Have you seen them getting more extreme? Have you noticed summer's getting hotter, winter's getting warmer, summer nights not getting as cool? Join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked outside in high heat? What is that like? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jeff Goodell is a journalist and author. He's covered climate change for more than two decades. His new book is The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. It's a New York Times bestseller. Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, Jeff, you've been covering climate change, global warming for a couple decades now. This book, I think, is looking to turn up our sense of urgency a little bit. Can you talk about what you're trying to communicate here?
Well, you're exactly right. I am trying to turn up the urgency a little bit. And it came out of a personal experience of mine. You know, I've been writing about climate change for more than 10 years and, you know, thought a lot about heat in the sense of global warming, the general idea of a warming planet. But the immediacy and risk of it was not anything I really thought about until I took a walk about 15 blocks on a 115 degree day in Phoenix, Arizona. And by the time I got to my destination at the other side of town, you know, I was feeling lightheaded and my heart was pounding. And I really realized that heat is a real immediate risk to people's lives. And the book was sort of born out of that experience. And I wanted to explore what heat means to us in the here and now as we live on this rapidly warming planet.
That reminds me that walk in Phoenix, you write that the human body, we have to think of it as a heat machine, and this delicate machine functions in a narrow area, kind of a Goldilocks zone, you say, of temperature conditions.
Yeah, I mean, we've evolved over the last, you know, several million years to in a relatively narrow band of temperature. You know, there's been, you know, hotter and colder times, but our body is tuned to a particular climate. And what's happening now is as things get hotter and hotter, we're moving out of that temperature bounds. And our body is really good at you know, regulating its temperature. We don't have to think about it, right? You don't have to remind yourself to keep your body temperature at 98.6 degrees. Our body just does it. And we have a mechanism which we use to maintain that internal body temperature, which is sweat. Everyone knows that. But there's at a certain point when either you don't sweat enough because you have become dehydrated, or if the temperature gets beyond what the sweat can deal with, that you get in trouble because your internal body temperature starts to rise. So it's basically about moving out of this zone of comfort that our body is so finely tuned over evolutionary time to deal with.
You talk about two different types of heat stroke. Neither of them sound good. It's a difficult read in some cases. Can you tell us about classic and exertional heat stroke and how they affect us?
Right. So the two different types of heat stroke, classic heat stroke is the simplest explanation is, you know, kind of what happens to a child if you leave them, or a person, or an adult for that matter, but it's most often children that are sadly victims of this in a hot car. It is you're just in a hot environment and your body can't compensate for that heat, and your internal blood, internal body temperature rises and rises. You sweat as much as you want, but the heat is so extreme that that your body can't cool itself off. And that puts tremendous strain on the heart. Different people have different kind of vulnerabilities to it, depending on how strong their heart is and things like that. But eventually, at a certain point, it will kill anyone. Exertional heat stroke is an entirely different thing. Exertional heat stroke is the kind of thing that happens to outdoor workers a lot, farm workers, delivery people, athletes, in fact, who are out, exerting themselves. When you're exercising, you're generating a lot of internal body heat that adds to the outside heat that you're experiencing from the hot day, and that can be extremely dangerous also for the same kinds of reasons, is that you're reaching a body temperature that you can no longer dissipate the heat from, and it's putting tremendous strain on your heart and circulatory system, and if you don't find relief, you're in big trouble.
We're talking to Jeff Goodell, author of the new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jeff, you live in Texas, a place known for heat, but Texas, parts of Texas are hitting records this year. Phoenix, were you talking about that walk, a hot place getting hotter. What is extreme heat looking like in places that were already pretty hot?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in Austin right now, sitting here. It's 108 degrees. It's been over 102 degrees for, I think, 30 days now here. We're seeing these longer and longer heat waves that are hotter and hotter. And these are not really unexpected. These are within the kinds of climate that scientists have long been telling us that we are going to be experiencing as we continue to burn fossil fuels, which puts CO2 into the atmosphere, which is raising the temperatures on the planet. On an average, they're rising, but also it is creating these more extreme weather events, and this additional warmth causes these more extreme heat waves, like we're seeing here. We're seeing heat waves in unexpected places, the Pacific Northwest in 2021. Wisconsin is not known, of course, as a place where you've experienced a lot of extreme heat waves, but it is now in this sort of new climate, a place where I would not be surprised to see temperatures far beyond what you're used to at some point in the not so distant future. And so it's sort of the rising warmth of our planet has changed the sort of atmospheric dynamics so that these extreme events are much more common and much more unexpected.
You also visited Antarctica, not a place we think of as hot, but by Antarctic standards, it's had extreme heat, and that could have very dangerous effects for us. What did you see there?
Yeah, Antarctica is a place that's, long been thought of as a very cold, very stable place, where the larger warming of the planet has been very slow to reach for various reasons that were not worth going into. The Arctic to the north has been warming basically four times faster than the rest of the planet, but Antarctica to the south has not been. And so there was a lot of thought that, Antarctica was a kind of stable exception to this sort of larger warming. But I went down there because I learned about some research some scientists were doing about the temperature changes in the ocean. And we talk about temperature changes, we're often talking about land temperature, which is where we live, and so that's what we think about. But ocean temperatures are really important. And what's happening in Antarctica is that the Southern Ocean, the temperature there, the average temperature there has risen just 1 degree Fahrenheit, which is hardly, you would think, hardly noticeable. But it has changed the melt rate of the bottom of the glaciers, where the glaciers meet the sea, and allowed the ocean water to get underneath these glaciers, and is destabilizing these enormous glaciers in Antarctica. And this has huge consequences for every kind of coastal city in the world, because as these big glaciers melt and collapse into the sea, they accelerate sea level rise. And so the point that I wanted, why I wanted to go there, is to show that even small changes in temperature in places like the Southern Ocean can have enormous implications.
We're talking to journalist Jeff Goodell about his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When it's hot, do you rely on air conditioning, maybe for a medical condition or other risk factors for heat stroke? Do you worry as you watch these rising temperatures around the country? Have you experienced high heat, maybe working outside yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or your questions for our guest. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with journalist Jeff Goodell about his new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What action, if any, do you want to see taken when it comes to climate change and fossil fuel emissions? Do you feel optimistic that we can deal with rising temperatures, or are you worried? Did you move here, maybe to Wisconsin, from a hot place at some point in your life, in part because of worries about the heat? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff, I want to talk about how we talk about heat. You write in the book, you know, hot is a euphemism for sexy. Warming sounds kind of nice. It's hard to take pictures of climate change as opposed to extreme heat in particular, as opposed to the impact of a hurricane or an earthquake or something like that. Is part of the story a communications problem here?
Yeah, it is. And it's a deep and complex communications problem. I mean, you know, things, other kind of climate related, you know, events like, you know, hurricanes, droughts, all those kinds of things are very easy to visualize. We see them. We know, you know, we can tell looking out our window if the wind is blowing 20 miles an hour or 120 miles an hour. It looks very different. You know, roofs are flying off houses at 120 miles an hour. Heat, you know, I'm looking out my window in Austin right now, and I can't tell if it's 70 degrees out there or 120 degrees. It looks exactly the same. So there's no visual, you know, messaging that helps us understand the risks of heat. It's only when, like I did on my walk in Phoenix, you go out and your heart starts pounding and you start feeling lightheaded and you think, oh my gosh, this is dangerous. I'm in trouble. And so, and this is, you know, part of the problem with the way we talk about global warming. Global warming just sounds like better beach weather. It doesn't sound like very worrisome at all. So, and people talk about, scientists talk about, you know, 2 degrees of warming. And to most people, 2 degrees of warming just sounds like nothing. It's like the difference between a 78 degree day and an 80 degree day. It doesn't sound worrisome at all. So there's a lot of problems in how we have come to understand and calculate the sort of risks of this warming that we're experiencing.
You also focus on who is hardest hit by extreme heat. If you can afford in a hot place like Texas or Phoenix, to have air conditioning and stay inside it, it may not feel like a big deal. But you look at migrant workers who work in fields or people who live in Chennai, India, in shacks. Talk about how the impacts are unevenly distributed.
Yeah, in the book, I talk about a kind of bright line between the cooled and the damned, meaning people who have access to refuge on hot days and in hot weather, who are privileged enough not to have to work outdoors and experience the heat, and who don't have to make a choice between, you know, being productive in their jobs and, you know, risking their lives to do it. You know, the people who are most, you know, heat is predatory. It goes after people who are, you know, have weaker hearts, who have poor circulatory systems, who are forced to work outside. I mean, I'm here in Texas and I look at these workers outside, you know, in the middle of, on a day like today, 106 degrees, who are working on the rooftops, putting on new roofs and stuff. And the kind of what the risks that they're dealing with in doing that kind of thing. Farm workers too. I write about the death of a farm worker in Oregon due to the fact that he was out in a field working on an extremely hot day. He knew he was at risk. He knew the dangers of extreme heat, but he also knew that if he took a shade break, started and took breaks to drink water, he would likely be fired. And there's no labor laws protecting at that time in Oregon. There have been some passed now, but there were no laws protecting the workers from these extreme heat conditions, insisting on breaks for 10 minutes every hour or something like that. So there's a real, you know, it's really easy to say, oh yeah, let's just get everybody air conditioning and it'll be fine. But that's not the way the real world is going to work.
Talking to Jeff Goodell about his book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. Jeff, I want to talk about some solutions you look at in the book. And on the communications front, things like naming our heat waves and other communications efforts to communicate the impact of these extreme events. Where do you see success stories?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, this question about kind of just getting smart about the risk of heat and understanding how dangerous it is, understanding why dry heat is less dangerous than wet heat, for example, because of the wet heat, it's more difficult for your sweat to evaporate. Getting better with a kind of media messaging and public health messaging. I mean, think about what happens when you have a tornado coming through, or when you have, if you live on the coast, a hurricane. The government has all kinds of ranking systems, you know, category one, category two, category three. It tells you immediately a lot about the wind speed, about the risks. You have a lot of information about evacuation routes. You have a lot of, everybody knows kind of what to do. It's drilled into their heads in a very clear way. The entire government mobilizes around keeping people safe. That does not happen during heat waves. At most, you might get some kind of alert on your phone, but there's no sense of what to do, where to go, how dangerous is it? Is it a really bad heat wave? Is it not? So I think there can be a lot done just in the simple sense of preparing and educating people for what to do during the heat waves. And then there's things like, of course, cutting fossil fuel consumption, because that's what's driving the heat. Building cities with more green spaces, more nature in cities, more shade, more refuge for people. Here in Austin, we have like a public park with a big pool, a natural spring in it that is a haven during hot days. Things like that that allow people access to public spaces that are cooler during hot weather.
Do you see widespread efforts to do that in communities to take, these cities that are already heat islands in some ways, more so as climate change heats them up more, to combat that heat island phenomenon?
Yeah, you know, there's beginning to be efforts, but I mean, let's be frank. I mean, it's, you know, cities are built over many decades, if not centuries. It's going to take a long time to refashion a place like Phoenix or a place like Austin. And, you know, it's going to take a long time to change the sort of physical geography of these kinds of places. It's going to take a long time for people to figure out ways to get more air conditioning to people who can't afford it. And, you know, in certain ways, places like some of the studies have shown, the mortality studies of heat waves have shown that places like Madison and northern cities who really are not equipped to deal with heat at all, people don't think about heat waves, that they don't have, just like when the ice storm hit Texas. If you live in Wisconsin, you know how to deal with an ice storm. An ice storm hit Texas, you know, 2 years ago when I was here, and people just freaked out. They had no idea what to do. And so there's a strong case to be made that northern cities are sort of, people who live in northern cities are kind of more at risk from these sort of freakish and extreme and increasingly hot weather patterns that are going to be emerging in the future than places in heat savvy cities like Austin. Even though the temperatures and stuff might be higher, at least there's a higher level of knowledge of what to do during these kinds of extreme conditions.
You talked to one expert in one of your visits to Phoenix, I think it was, who was warning of, you know, a Katrina-level heat event if one of these heat waves coincides with a power outage. What are the worst-case scenarios people are worried about?
Well, they're pretty horrific. You know, one of the things about air conditioning is, you know, everyone thinks that, you know, I have air conditioning, I don't have to worry about any of this. Whatever the temperature is, I'll just crank up my AC and it's all fine. But that works well as long as the grid is up and stable. During extreme heat events, the grid load is very, very high. We're feeling that in Texas right now. Yesterday, I think, was a record-breaking demand on the Texas grid. Thank God it was stable. But during these kinds of events, the grid is liable, is more vulnerable to blackouts. And if you have a massive blackout, which has happened, it happened here in Texas in the winter. If you had a 2 or 3 day blackout, you could have massive casualties. I mean, one study that I cited in my book, talks about 80,000 people dying in a city like Phoenix over if there was a blackout that lasted more than 36 hours. Because what happens is, we've built, especially in these hot cities, we've built these buildings with sealed windows. You can't open the windows. They work fine if there is air conditioning, but if the air conditioning fails and the power fails, then they become convection ovens and there's nowhere to go. And it's a kind of horrific scenario.
Did you, in our last minute or so, Jeff, come out of this long project leading to The Heat Will Kill You First with any sense of optimism?
I do. I actually am a some people have been critical of me of being sort of excessively optimistic, but I really do think that heat is really these heat waves we're seeing is really driving home to millions of people that climate change is not a far off distant event. It's really happening fast. It's happening now. Our lives are at stake, and that we can make changes to do things differently. We can get our energy from a different place. We can build cities in different ways. We can grow food in different ways. There's a lot of possibility for kind of building a better world, but we have to be engaged. We have to understand the risks that we face, and we have to get politically involved because this is not just about technology and culture. This is also about politics.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jeff Goodell, journalist and author. He talked to us about his new book. It's called The Heat Will Kill You First: Life and Death on a Scorched Planet.